Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Call in or just listen in as guest, Frans Dahl, a former 27-year warden from Amsterdam, who has worn many hats in areas of criminal justice, whom has and continues to work with the Dutch Ministry of Justice, the United Nations, the ICRC, the Global Initiative on Psychiatry, Mainland and Council of Europe, returns to work to discuss some other things. I also want to introduce, as many of you know as well, Donna Wynette, founder of Families, Friends, and Individuals for the Mentally Ill, who has been working ceaselessly on a lot of changes in the United States prison system, especially Bridgewater State Hospital. So, Franz, you want to talk a little bit about yourself and then Donna, and then we can get on with the show.
All right. Thank you very much, Leona. Well, first, I would like to congratulate Nanan McCune-Williams, my friend who is doing a life sentence in the prison in Texas for a crime he didn't commit. I know a lot of people say that they didn't commit their crimes, but in this case, I'm sure that that's true, and we expect him to get out within a year. So for years he is in the process of trying to get out, and it seems that he's going to succeed. So congratulations, Nanan, and also Tara, his girlfriend, who is not his girlfriend, it's his wife, actually, because they married in prison a few weeks ago. Congratulations, and hope we will meet you soon outside the prison.
Awesome.
So, and while telling about myself, I started to work with juveniles when I was 20. I worked in forensic psychiatry for 10 years, became head of a department in an institute for pre-trial forensic psychiatric observation and advice of the judge, and after that I became a warden for 27 years. And well, one specific thing is that I did projects all over the world, knowledge exchange, which I think is very interesting and broadens your view on the world. And I still do that. I'm leaving for Ukraine in September for a project on psychiatry, a psychiatric department on PTSS in the prison system of Ukraine, which is very necessary. And the other thing is that I'm started a foundation 12 years ago, which is called Recovery and to Return. And we bring all people involved in the whole process of crime, punishment, recovery, and return. We bring them together. And one of the things we do is the podcast Prison Show. It's a name that we choose because I was guest of the Prison Show in Houston many times. And I asked them if I could use their name, and they were honored. So we made until now about 206 podcasts. We make one every week, so we do it for 4 years now. And to give you an idea about, shall I continue, or let's listen to Donna first, probably.
Oh, thank you, Franz. I'll just give a brief introduction. I'm the founder and director of Family and Friends of Individuals with Mental Illness, which is FFIMI, FIMI. We advocate for those with serious mental illness who are justice involved. They find themselves enmeshed within the system, mostly because previously services, mental health services, were hard to obtain. They just fell through cracks of the system. Unfortunately, they suffered, many of them suffered psychosis, breaks from reality, and they find themselves at Bridgewater State Hospital in Massachusetts. And what happens is that the hospital, not really a hospital, it's actually a prison, but supposedly they give hospital care, but they work to bring these people who are broken in mind back to competency. And once they achieve competency, they move them into the jails and prisons. So, you know, even if they're not really fully culpable because of their mental disease, once they're competent legally, then they're put in jails and prisons where they do not belong, where they do not get enough medical care, and especially the mental health care they need. So we march on as a strong advocacy group, and we do not give up, and we fight for the voiceless, we fight for the vulnerable, we fight for our loved ones.
Thank you both so much, so much.
Sounds like great work, Donna.
Thank you. Thank you. It's really done with heart. I'm actually grateful to do this work. I get to know these patients at the hospital. I conduct art classes. I visit my grandson often. The families have a camaraderie. And there's so much unconditional love among this group for their loved ones and for one another. It's amazing the support we give one another. We have such an understanding. And we even throw in a little humor here and there.
That's nice. That's very nice.
This is why it's so honorable to have both of you on the show, because you two have a passion, and it's so transparent, and so many people out there advocating, it's not as transparent as the two of you have been. Well, so again, I want to thank you both for being on. Franz, now I also wanted to remind everyone, Franz has a radio podcast himself, www.prisonshow.nl for the Netherlands. And Franz will be talking a little bit about that, too, I hope, to give us some feedback or some information on his information on the show.
Yeah, today we had a recording day of the prison show. We had four guests today. And to give you an idea about how we approach the whole subject of dealing with recovery, return, criminality, punishment, etc. I tell you a bit about our guests. This morning we started with a very special guest, and this guy, originally Turkish, he has a very special job, a very special company, the first in the Netherlands. He is cleaning on spots with extreme dirt and extreme circumstances, like houses where people, dead people were in for a week or a year or sometimes 10 years. He cleans the whole environment. For example, people who neglected themselves, who are living in dirt and in very bad circumstances, often addicted people, very lonely people. He cleans their house, and also families who are in the circumstance that they the parents are not able to take care of their children well, and it can happen that the whole house is filled with dirty diapers and food and all kinds of stuff. And those kind of situations he's cleaning. And that's very extreme and a very special specialism and professionality. But the most heartwarming thing is the way he talks about the people he's helping. Like he says, well, we all think that the people who are in such kind of circumstances are totally different from us, and they are neglecting themselves, and they are crazy, and nobody realizes that everybody could get in those kind of situations. And he tells a story about especially the people who end up because of suicide and neglection and live in a house like that. And he says, well, it's often that people experienced very bad experiences during their youth, like abuse or violence and things like that, and they start to have a very good life with a family and good work and good job, and sometimes they are very successful, and then when they are about 40 years, 45 years, they collapse, you know. Their past jumps on them, and they get into trouble, they divorce, they start using drugs, drinking, etc., etc., and they end up in a total deplorable situation. And he, well, the interesting message of this guy is that by showing them respect, showing their family respect, doing his job very professional, he contributes to the human dignity of all the people he deals with, like, for example, people who were alone for decades and who were totally alone in their houses. And he, by doing this job very, very neatly and very professional, he gives them a new start, like, and he, there's a lot of shame involved for both the families, but also for the persons involved who live in a very dirty house, for example. And one of the first things he says is, well, it's not such a mess. We just fix it very quickly. It's no problem. I've seen a lot worse than what I've seen there in your house, etc., etc. So he convinced them that he accepts them as a person. And the fact that he does that has a very, very powerful, is very powerful in the life of those people. So he was a very interesting guest, I can say. Can you imagine that?
Pardon?
What do you think of that, of that story?
I think go ahead, Leona.
No, I was going to say, please, Donna.
I just think it's the most humane and heartwarming story. You know, when we can reach out to those who others might think are less than and lift them up, it's one of the best gifts we can give to a fellow human. It's a very wonderful, wonderful thing he's doing.
That's nice to hear, yeah.
And I think really those are things that are needed all over the place, in this country as well as others, because Donna just said it, people that are thought of less than others. I think everyone's created equally, and I think everyone should have that feeling and should have the same respect from whether they're falling, whether they're substances or mental illnesses or whatever the case may be. I think it's very important to make these people feel not only human, but feel equal to those who are trying to help them as well.
Yeah, very true. There was a television program about him on Dutch television, with about 15 episodes about his work, which really promoted the awareness of people about the people who get in situations like that. Often psychiatric patients get in those kind of situations, and sometimes often he really when he cleans their home in the way he does, he really makes the situation available for other people who could help. And sometimes it's a life-changing event when he does that for the people. Because, you know, for example, when he has been in a house and he worked very hard for about a week to clean everything, he talks with the neighbors, he talks with the family, and then, for example, some neighbors start cleaning his house once a week. With three or four neighbors, they clean his house for 1 or 2 hours, you know, which is enough to keep the house clean. So he also tries to reconnect the social environment and the network with those people. I think that's very nice too. And the other one that we had today was a guy who was brought up in a trailer park, but a trailer park of travelers. I don't know if you know the term, travelers. people who live originally traveled through Europe, and today they are in these camps, sort of trailer camps. And this guy became connected to very severe criminality, drug criminality. And he was in there, in the drugs criminality, for about 20 years, with a lot of violence, etc., etc. And since about 10 years, he is doing very good work. He is giving lectures, and he is working with children in a children camp, cooks meals for them, etc., etc. And the podcast was about the PTSS he had after his criminal career, because he wasn't the guy who did a lot of violence himself, but he was involved in others, with others who committed violence, and he also saw all kinds of violence. For example, he tells about because he was a sort of helper of big criminals, so one day he had to they came with a car, and in the car there was a dead guy. They killed him, and then they told him to get rid of the car, and he pushed the car into the water, but his coat got stuck to the car, and it draw him into the water, and he went underwater. He almost drowned, and he finally got out of the water. And those experiences, he put him away somewhere, and after that he get a lot of nightmares and a lot of PTSS, traumatic things. And while he was talking about that sometimes we forget that being in a criminal environment and being involved in those kind of crimes also causes severe trauma, and you have to do something with it, because otherwise it can cause new crimes as well, because people really have to get over it and deal with it. You know, they can't be healthy before they and rehabilitate before they have dealt with those kind of trauma. So it was a bit of a very special subject to talk about. Then we talked about. Then we had another guest today. It was a lady who. A black lady who comes from Suriname, which is one of the former colonies in the Netherlands. And what she does is training prison staff to deal with racism, to deal with, to include everybody, and to deal with their prejudice towards other groups, you know? Mm. So, it was a very inspiring, energetic lady. She's 71 years old, still working the whole week and doing these trainings with prison guards. And what she tries to do is she starts by asking them in the teams, do you know each other? And they say, well, we know each other. Huh? We work every day together. And then everybody tells his own story, and then they find out that they don't know anything about each other. They just don't know each other, and they have their opinion about others, but they, you know, they say hello, but they don't know that somebody, for example, is brought up in a foster home, or had an addiction, or stuff like that, you know. And the situations of people, personal situations of people, and then they try to learn the people to not judge about other people, but be interesting, look at other people with interest, be curious, When you have an idea, if you have a question, post this question. Check with the other what you how he is and what he is, and so don't judge, just ask and check with other people with attention and with interest. That's what he tries to learn, those people, because when you know everybody's story, because everybody has an interesting story and an own individual unique story, every person in the world, if you know this story, everybody, it's a way to give everybody his own place, because when you know the story, you understand where somebody comes from, and it's easier to accept everybody the way he is or she is. And it was a very interesting podcast, because she also did a lot of spoke a lot about a bit of racism, which she experienced herself as well when she came to the Netherlands, which is not very outspoken, and people often don't know that they are hurting the other person. But it is very, it's a sort of invisible, and everybody who is from a different ethnic group experiences that, and a lot of white Dutch people are not aware of the fact that they do that. Yeah? For example, when you meet somebody who is black, and you're just meeting, and when you're telling within 2 minutes, well, one of my best friends is also black, for example, she gave it as an example, then the fact that you know somebody or are a friend with somebody who is a black, can I use that word? I would ask you, can I use the word black?
Well, that's what they use in the United States. That's what they use in the United States. I myself go by people's nationality, like African Americans, or you know, or Africans, or French, or Irish, or whatever. But in the United States, they use the word black, and that, I guess, that includes black, brown, beige, red. I don't know, but the way I look at it is, we all have a culture and we all have a title, but in the United States, they use that as well. So yes, you can use that word.
Yeah, she used it herself. And she also spoke about Suriname itself, because the black people that came from Africa, they went straight to Suriname to work there as slaves. And in Suriname, you have also the people with an Indian background, Hindustan people. You have Indians, you have Chinese people, it's a mix of cultures. And one of the things she heard in on school in Suriname was that the more colored people were, the lower they were in hierarchy. So when you were really black, you were the lowest category. The highest category was being white. And then you had all those categories of being a little bit colored, more colored, etc., etc., you know? And she, one of her teachers said that, and said to her, so you are from the lowest category. And that really was a life-changing experience for her, to hear that about herself. And some people would be totally, you know, probably be not couldn't process such like that. But how she reacted was that she said, "Well, I will show you how low I am, and I'm going to fight against it." So she went to the Netherlands. She went to study, and she became a very important and a very famous therapist over here. And she is also in the list of the 100 business women in the Netherlands, you know, somewhere in the 98th place or so. So she's a very successful person. She really dedicated her life in proving that she could do it, you know. So very, very powerful and very interesting lady. Well, another person was Yassine. He was there. He was in the top 600 criminals of Amsterdam. He's from a Moroccan background, and there were so many problems with criminality and Moroccan people, youngsters, that they took they made a project for these 600 most difficult and most problematic young people, and he was one of them. And he tells how he changed his life, and he became a coach, and he's working at schools. He's a very positive, very energetic guy. And he said, well, when you're teaching, look further than only the classroom, and focus on the world, the world of the young people. I speak their language and I know where they come from. So he's doing a very important job of things, because we all look at into the world from our own character and from our own position, our own cultural backgrounds. That's people, we people are very limited. Huh? We can only look from our own point of view. And guys like Yassine, they can build a bridge between the world of the policymakers, the people who think they can, they have the solutions for people who have a total different situation and total different background, and people like Yassine, they can build a bridge between the different thinking worlds of the groups in society. So it was a very, I think it was a very nice nice podcast. Then we had a podcast about a criminologist. She did the art of punishing. She made how do you call it? The when you are already she promoted on university. PhD, yeah, I think you called it that way. And what she says is that it's almost not possible to when you treat people in forensic psychiatry, it's almost not possible to prove that the treatment diminishes the recidivism. That's what she says. And she that it's not proven that when you treat somebody for his mental disorders, that the fact that you treat somebody causes less recidivism. And I really, it was very interesting, because and I also can connect to that, can relate to that, because not being in criminality again is a very complex matter. You know, the choices people make is based on very complex and very a lot of different factors. You know, it's not only your mental disorder, but it's also your circumstances, your context, your social network, and all kinds of other factors that play a role in being able to not using violence anymore and not committing crimes anymore.
I would like to have Donna give some feedback on that, but I wanted to say something about that. What you're saying is that she was saying that that treatment of mental illness decreases recidivism rates. What she was saying was that doesn't necessarily have to be true.
Yeah, what she says is we didn't prove that there is a clear connection between treatment of mental illness and recidivism.
I want to say something on that because I kind of like disagree with her. First of all, I wanted to say, Donna, you give your feedback. I'm going to see who this is.
I'll wait for you, Leona. I would like to think that there is less recidivism. Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I would like to think there is less recidivism with treatment. To help someone get mentally well, I would think would help. And if they have cognitive behavioral therapy, known as CBT, cognitive behavioral therapies, and the right, proper medication that's been tried and tested, I would hope that, there would be, and then also support services, ongoing continuum of care. I have to agree with Leona that, I might not agree with that. I would really think that those strong factors all in place would reduce recidivism.
Well, what I think is that, and that's where I can relate to that, when somebody develops mental problems, which usually starts when they are in the puberty, when they are young, 13, 14, 16, 18, people can develop mental illnesses, mental problems, and a very, very important factor is how the environment reacts on that, how they react on school, how the parents react, how the neighborhood reacts, how the family reacts on that. We are talking about a forensic situation, usually when somebody doesn't get proper care, has a lot of other experience, like not being part of society, being excluded of society in all kinds of ways. So somebody with a mental problem who is not helped and who is deprived from a supportive social environment, easily gets into a situation in which he starts doing the things where he goes to prison for,
I was just going to say, I have an incarcerated individual on the phone right now from Pennsylvania. And one of the things I wanted to have him relate feedback on this, but at the same time, I want you to know that his father committed suicide years ago, and his only sibling committed suicide, and his mother died of cancer not long ago. And his name is Kelly Donahue, and Kelly has been Kelly, I'd like you to talk to the audience and to Franz and Donna Wynette, and let them know what your feelings were throughout the time that you were going through all these changes and what led you to the drinking and the incarceration.
Hello, Kelly.
Hi, Kelly.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Franz was talking about an individual who was speaking about the possibility that treatment for mental health issues does not actually reduce the recidivism rate. And Franz was just saying that he feels that it's circumstances as well, and that is true. And I'd like to have you talk about the psychological traumas that you were going through and also the experiences you went through. And
call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Brackville.
And what
call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Now, Samson, which is what we call him, Kelly Donahue, he was released about 5 years ago and sent back in because he violated his parole, I guess, in drinking. But I'm going to let Kelly talk. Okay, Kelly, please explain your situation.
Well, just like pretty much anybody else, it's been in that prison. I started whenever I was young. I was 15 years old. And the first time I was incarcerated was for something I didn't actually do, accessory to breaking and entering. I knew who did it. That was all. So my mother was told to take me to the police department. You know, tell them the truth. That's all you got to do. You won't be in no trouble. Well, I told them the truth, told them what I knew, and the only one that got in trouble was me. So I got incarcerated. That was my first time being locked up. I got 6 months. This was in North Carolina. In Durham, in Butner, down by Butner Federal Prison, called they call them training schools. Up here they call them reform schools. They call them training schools down there. Well, of course, you know, that, like she's talking about, the psychological effect that had on me was profound. I ended up trying to kill myself while I was in there. I hung myself, ended up laying on the floor, woke up, and, you know, I was crying, and the next thing I know, I'm freaking out trying to get out of this cell that they had me. It was supposed to be a room. It was concrete slab, just like a morgue setting. So they ended up taking me and putting me in a school, which is, they just locked you into a school with a bunch of other kids that, you know, that are pretty much hardened criminals by the time you got to the state that I was at. And that was from the system that they were in. Well, I tried to escape. I jumped through a window and tried to escape from the place.
This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Brackville.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Of course, they caught me and put me back into it. So my point is, you know, I went from being a nonviolent person to, you know, just an innocent kid that didn't do anything. And just did what I was supposed to do and then got locked up for telling the truth. Well, while I was in there, I learned that you don't talk to the police. You know, I wasn't racist. I wasn't prejudiced. I wasn't antisocial or anything. But that was the start of becoming all of these things, you know, later on in life. I'm 50 years old now. And since I was 15, I've only spent 3 years of my life out there. And that wasn't all one time either. It was like 6 months here, a year there, a couple months. And like parole, probation, and all that stuff just kept bringing me back. Things that wouldn't normally get me locked up, because I was on probation or parole, got me locked up. It's like moving an address, or like she was saying, like drinking a beer, getting drunk, or anything. You know, the stuff that normally wouldn't get you locked up got me locked up. So anyhow, fast forward a little bit. Like she was saying about my mom and my dad and my brother. A good friend of mine, when he came back up here in 97, committed suicide in front of me. He jumped out in front of a truck. Got splattered all over a highway. You know, Stockdale was his name. And then 9 months later, my dad committed suicide. So I ended up going to prison for, you know, the aggravated assault on the police officer and all this other nonsense I had up here in Pennsylvania. So while I was in prison, my little brother committed suicide. Then my mom died of cancer. That was 10 years ago that that happened. Well, I ended up getting out not long after they ended up dying, right? Well, my mom's house is down in North Carolina. I'm stuck on parole up here, and they won't let me go down there and do anything with the house. I can't fix it up. I can't go down there and sell it. I can't get it with my name unless I'm physically down there to do it. I didn't have the money to pay an attorney or anything like that. So as far as I know, I probably lost the house. So I ended up, I was doing good. I was working, had my own place, and I was with somebody. We were rafting down the river. Somebody almost ran us over with a car. We're on our way to go to a pizza shop. And he got an altercation with somebody. That didn't have nothing to do with me. The police shows up, wants to know what's going on. Guy even explained to him, you know, that it was him and it wasn't me. Because I'm the only one that was on parole, so they started zeroing in on me. And here I'm in York County. Well, they have a jail down there where they contract for parole violators, state parole violators, illegal immigrants, so on and so forth. So, of course, me being on state parole, they took me down there. Oh, well, guess what? We're going to charge you with resisting arrest because I didn't want to have anything to do with what was going on. Now I'm resisting arrest, which I didn't, right? Mm-hmm. So they ended up sending me back for 3.5 years for that, which was a misdemeanor 3, which is something that normal people wouldn't get locked up for, wouldn't go to prison for. So this has a psychological effect on you where, you know, you end up becoming antisocial, even a borderline sociopath. Because now you know the difference between right and wrong, but it just doesn't seem to matter if you do what's right or wrong, because you're always going to get, you know, the worst end of that deal if a situation like that goes down. And like she was saying, a few years ago, I was, over 3 years ago, I got out again. Well, they took me to this community correction center in Harrisburg called Keystone, and it's a halfway back place. I'm on my way out. They're sending me to a place that's halfway back, and this is one of the ways they sent you up for failure. So it's just like being in prison. It's got a fence around it. You know, you're gated in. You got doors that you got to go through. You got to get buzzed to get in and out. And you got to go through an act of Congress to get a job to be able to get out of that place. And they try to keep you where you're working for the people that they have contracts for $89 an hour, where they're taking over half your paycheck. You've got to pay for them to transport you back and forth to work. They won't let you get a driver's license. They won't let you get a car, so you have to keep depending on them. And then they don't want to feed you anything, so you got to spend the overloaded prices in their vending machine. And then by the end of the week, you got like $30 left. So at that rate, you can't never get out of it. Well, I went and found myself a good job, paying $22 an hour starting out, which is pretty good for someone that's just coming out of prison. And wouldn't you know, the work release coordinator, Janet Castle, she decided she's going to change my hours. So my hours were supposed to be 6 in the evening to 6 in the morning, which I could get a bus back and forth. She changed to 6 in the morning, 6 in the night, where I couldn't even get to work and I couldn't even get back. So I went to my pro agent, tried to explain to him what the deal was. He didn't want to hear it. He said, well, you got to get yourself a car if you're going to get your driver's license. You got to get insurance and all this stuff. So I talked to my friend of mine. He put me to work for the weekend. It was legit work, cash money. Ended up getting myself a car, got my insurance on it. You know, it's like a $400 Ford Taurus. And the insurance and stuff cost more than the car itself did. So I go back to my pro agent on a Tuesday, and I tell him I did exactly what he told me to do. So then he's like, well, I think you should go take another drug and alcohol assessment. I had a DUI for 20 years earlier, and that's what he's referring to, is that. He's trying to make me do stuff over. So he didn't even want me to get a driver's license. He didn't want me to get out of here. So one day I came back from work, and they always give us a breathalyzer. Well, I'm not drinking. I'm not doing nothing. I've had this breathalyzer 5 times. This was 2 days before Christmas, and this kid that was working there, he's like 19 years old, he blows into this breathalyzer, makes a noise, and he tells me to blow into it, and I do, and he tells me I'm positive for alcohol. Well, you know, I just slapped. Flip right out. I'm not going to spend the Christmas, Thanksgiving, everything else locked up again. I hadn't been out for 20 years. You know, I really don't have no family or anybody to celebrate anything with. But, you know, I was tired of being accused of doing things that I wasn't doing and suffering the consequences.
I think that's what happens in a lot of these cases. And when, Franz, when you mentioned circumstances, in addition to the psychological issues, this is what's going on. And I'll tell you
what.
Can I
react on
yes,
Kelly's story? Kijk,
yes.
What I hear is that when you were still a child, you were incarcerated for a crime you didn't commit. And from that moment, all kinds of things happened to you. Somebody did something with your real needs to get your life on the rails, you know, to get your life straight. The only thing you experienced was repression, suppression, all kinds of mechanism that don't support you to deal with your issues and with your anger and your problems, etc., etc., but just reactions to give you a hard time and give you a hard life. That's what I hear all the time. So often when people with mental problems who experience very difficult things in their life, like the suicide and other violence around you, and incarceration, etc., etc. What people need is support to deal with those kind of things.
Exactly.
And what I hear is that you only, that's the last thing they provided you with, the last thing. So I don't think when you treat people like that, who walk around with those experiences, because I also can imagine, and I think I hear that in your voice, that you're become very angry and very desperate because those situations happen all the time, you know? So mental treatment for things that society and other people and the system do to you, that's not the kind of treatment what I'm talking about, you know? That treatments are for mental problems, for mental illness, and not for for injustice that is done to you and harm that is done to you, I think.
Now, mental illnesses to me is psychological, serious psychological issues. And I tell you, I experienced myself with a lot of individuals throughout the country. Mental illness is a big thing, and one of the things Donna Wynette's group is trying to do is to get Department of Mental Health involved, because the Department of Mental Health talks about prisoners being too violent to help, and at the same time, they're assisting individuals on the outside, many of whom are worse than those on the inside. So I believe if the Department of Mental Health is going to work with psychologically ill or mentally ill, seriously mentally ill individuals, they need to look at all of them. It's like the post office, the United States Postal Service. They say, when I complained about the mail not getting to the incarcerated, they said that they send the mail to the prison, from the prison, let me just hang up with this. From the prison, it's up to the Department of Corrections to ensure that these individuals get their mail. And one last thing I want to say, when I did social work and for the Department of Social Services years ago, one of the things I found fault with them is that they finally came up with this thing that if a child, the youngest child is 5 years of age, the parent had to go to work and the child had to go into daycare. They planned this, which is a good idea, but at the same time, they forget a lot of these people didn't have driver's license or vehicles, or a lot of them have to be at work before the daycare is open. So when even our government today, to this day, when they put these plans together, they do not plan it out thoroughly, which means people are going to end up losing their benefits, or they're going to end up having problems because they're not, the leaders, the lawmakers are not figuring or planning all the way.
Yeah. So I think that's my point too. Before you talk about forensic psychiatry and big mental problems, start to treat people like human beings in a humane way. Respect human dignity, you know, because otherwise you are hurting people all the time and not respecting people and damaging people at one hand and traumatizing them, and in the other hand you say, well, I'm going to treat him, you know, that's a strange combination. Start giving him the respect that he needs, and then we are also talking about work, meaningful activities, stuff like that, and then the pathology of a mental problem of trauma can be treated as well, but it's not the only thing, and not even the most important thing.
Leona, I think I'd love to weigh in. You know, I know one of France's topics is relations between staff and inmates, and before I go to that, though, I just want to say I hope Kelly's listening. I send him my sincere condolences. He's had a lot of losses, and I have a nephew who committed suicide less than a year ago. I watch my sister and my nieces grieve. I grieve as well. So my condolences to you, Kelly. Thank you for speaking up. And in saying that, I'd like to speak up for another inmate. And this was just posted. This is our latest post on ffimi.blog. And it's written by an incarcerated individual who struggled with mental illness since childhood. So it's called, and it's anonymous, it's a true story. It's called The Price of a Mint Leave, A Day in the Life on the Inside. It feels good to have my hands in the dirt, the smell of the earth, the pulling of weeds up between the bright green flourishing plants, the coolness of the water from the garden hose on a steamy hot summer day. It's a welcome break to be outdoors, working with purpose, with others. I am lucky enough to be in the garden program at a Massachusetts Department of Corrections institution. I enjoy it. On the outside, in a previous life, I worked in landscaping. So the program offers not only opportunity to be outside in fresh air, but a small feeling of normalcy in an otherwise strange and foreign land, prison. It was just like a typical garden shift. I had been told by the supervisor that an occasional sampling of produce was allowable for those in the program. Therefore, I did not sneak or hide the harmless act I was about to take. I simply picked a sprig of mint, breathed in the fresh scent, and popped it into my mouth. Apparently, I was wrong. The correction officer came over and said I was not allowed to eat the produce. I replied that it was okay because I was in the garden program. I guess she thought I was being a smartass, but I wasn't. She informed me of the rule that produce is for donation only and not for personal consumption, and that she was going to report the incident to her supervisor for disciplinary action, which she did. This was my first ticket in prison. What will this mean for me? Will I get kicked out of the garden program or other programs? Will it impact my possibility of parole someday? I am angry, worried, and stressed. I can't think straight. I can't sleep. My chest feels tight, and I can't seem to breathe normally. The reality of never knowing all of the rules and if these rules will randomly be enforced is one of the many parts of prison life that wreaks havoc on my nervous system. Who is this new CO? What mood is she in today? Does she know me and know that I am not a troublemaker? I try to stay clear of any and all potential dangers, yet trouble seems inevitable. The emotions experienced due to this incident lasted for days, deeply impacting my quality of life. I share this story to show the unstable, unpredictable, inconsistent, soul-crushing environment we inmates live under. Sometimes we are treated like human beings, then not. We are viewed through a lens that says, I am better than you and I can do whatever I want to you. Today I can enforce a rule that you didn't even know about because I think you are a piece of shit. It is hard for me to convey to those on the outside what it's like. The suffocation and mental claustrophobia that goes with life inside these walls. This little taste of mint was costly. After several days, the guys on my unit and I began joking about the mint incident. Humor helps us to cope in this crazy land. I guess I'm lucky. I've been informed that this disciplinary action will not go to my permanent record if I don't get another ticket for the next 30 days. That should not be a problem, but I guess you never know. Anything can happen. And to follow up on that, he was forced to write a letter of apology saying, I'm sorry for eating a piece of mint.
Oh,
And that is incredible. This came straight from, you know, one of our persons from our circle.
Yeah, and this is very, it's very touching, and it's especially because I know it is like that. There's not one word not true in his message. You know, this is what happens. This has happened.
Yeah.
So what I always say is the quality of a prison. A prison is good when you your son can go to that prison and you can sleep and know that he's safe. So to create a secure environment in the prison is number one, and I'm very. Very, very. It's very hard to hear the story of this guy. It's incredible. It's incredible.
And it is known to, you know, those around, you know, in my circle that this person, you know, definitely does not want to make any kind of trouble. Tries to be a model. Tries to support his fellow inmates. So it's just heartbroken. And here's what my comment. I actually posted a comment, and I said, one of the concerns I have since studying the system of jails, prisons, and probation is the ease in which the system can play the gotcha game. for each and every infraction. Imagine if someone were tracking you 24/7 in every situation and through the most stressful of times. What would your report look like? What would the tracker's reports look like? Rather than encouragement towards a turning point of accountability, opportunity, and second chances, a gotcha attitude just serves to beat down those who desire to work towards progress and success. So that was my reaction to this article.
Yeah, great reaction. Yeah.
Franz, what is your advice? Yeah. What is your advice, Franz, to any commissioner, warden, in the prisons about that, about situations like that?
Well, first a remark about being a troublemaker. You know, people don't want to be a troublemaker, and there's a whole thing about troublemakers in prison and everywhere. I think that when somebody makes trouble, it could be a sign of being healthy, because when you're in such an inhuman environment, a sick environment, as the last guy who wrote this letter described, I think resistance is a very healthy reaction on a situation like that. You know, so that's. I just wanted to say that, and now I would like to go to the advice to the wardens and the people in charge in prisons. Talk to a few people in the prison who you think have the talent and the authority in the group of incarcerated people to start a pilot and to take the room to create a safe environment within the prison. Because actually the system can guarantee the safety and the security on the outside, and the community of incarcerated people has to create, supported by the staff and supported by the system, their own safe environment, you know? And that's very well possible if they get the room to follow their needs and to do things that are healthy for everybody. So I would say, when you're scared of people escaping or stuff like that, it's very easy to keep the prison closed and avoid that. But give some room to a few inmates together with a few guards, of course, to create a pilot in which incarcerated people can be safe. Like the guy, when I read this letter, I'm sure actually that he could contribute a lot to the prison community. He says a lot of sensitive things and very good things in his letter. So he is one of the people who could help to make a pilot successful, I think.
I believe those are the ones that the COs actually go after. I hate to say it, but I know for a fact there are incarcerated individuals that try to stay under the spotlight. They try to stay to themselves so that they're not being picked on. And yet somehow a lot of these COs manage to get to them and cause problems for them. You mentioned a garden. You mentioned in your country actually having that kind of a program for the incarcerated, and it gave them good feelings. I'm sure if one of them ate a mint leaf, I'm sure that you would not have said anything, or no one would have said anything to them. But in this country, any little thing that they do, as you say, they treat them like animals. They're not respected. They're not even asked, why are you doing this? Or I saw you eat a mint leaf. They just automatically try to make trouble for the individuals.
Yeah.
And one of the points, Leona, was that they actually had permission to do that.
So that's
from,
where they
from the supervisor, but the CO, you know, apparently was new, didn't know, and, you know, just carried it through in spite of the fact that it had been permissible. This person has to write a letter of apology. It's for eating a sprig of mint.
And they, well, she might not have been new, because when I trained with the Department of Corrections, as I mentioned, mental health management, one of the guards told me I should not be speaking with the prisoner. And when I brought it to my supervisor's attention, she said, Leona, she said, I speak to them all the time. She said, everyone is different in the way they do things. She says, I enjoy speaking with them because it's helping them. It's making them feel, as Franz always says, it's making them feel equal. It's not making them feel like they're below. And so I kept speaking to them. But that's why I ended up leaving at the end of my training, because I did not want conflict myself with guards that were going to be in opposition.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I did in the when I became a senior warden, and I was also a coach for the Ministry of Justice, so I coached a lot of new wardens in my country. I did that for many years, and one of the most complicated things for most new wardens is that they are at the top of the hierarchy. I hear that from this new guy who came in the example that the guy gave. And they don't know the consequences of their actions. They really don't know. They don't know what happens when they say, well, I don't want that, or that's not according to the rules. And they say it to the next level. And the next level says it to the next level. And then the next level, who are the guards? They are doing it, telling it to the incarcerated people. One of the most important things I try to learn those new wardens and new management people is to learn them that when you put a stone in the water, what kind of ripples there are around that and how far mm-hmm. they go, you know? Mm-hmm. The guy who... the top guy who decided this, the new guy, he had no idea about the consequences, I think. That's what I hear in the example.
Mm-hmm.
He was just, you know, thinking, I don't want that, or it's not okay, and then he just ordered it, you know, without knowing or probably even caring about the consequences.
Yeah.
Which is really a bad thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a little bit, he's a little bit like a 3-year-old boy which you give a sharp knife to play with, you know?
I think a lot of people, when they go to prison, they know that their freedom's taken from them. But I think they go in with the assumption that they're going to, it's like the outside of the prison. The environment is going to be the same as it was before they went to prison. But what they find out is the environment is not, like a lot of people say, the Department of Corrections, not the Department of Corrections, because they're not only having their freedom taken from them, but they're also being treated 10 times worse than they were on the outside, which is sad
yeah.
because they're not being rehabilitated. As you say, or as Kelly mentioned, they're made to get that frustration and anger because no one's helping them to try to do the right thing inside. And when they try to report the abuses and the deprivations and the provocations and all that to the outside world, no one is hearing them. So out of frustration, it becomes anger. Out of anger, it becomes strikes, it becomes riots, it becomes suicides, it becomes everything. And it should not be like this.
Yeah. Pretty true. Yeah.
I think, you know, the thing that is so hurtful is that there's a lack of, in many, not all, thank God, but there's a lack of, you know, feeling the worth of a human being. If you don't value another human being and all human beings, there's going to be trouble.
Very true. And people try to protect themselves because all those wardens and all those guards, they just want to survive as well in this destructive environment, which the prison is. they don't can get the tools and the space to turn it into something more positive, you know, together with the incarcerated people. So they survive in a system in which all people have their negative side and their positive side. There is cruelness and pain in one side, and in the other side there is love, you know. And when you live in a context, in an environment in which only the bad parts are focused on, then everything gets bad for everybody, you know. And that's and I see that is what happens all the time. It becomes a very unsafe, very destructive environment when you where people only can survive and there's no quality of existence whatsoever. So I think one of the very basic questions when you talk about prisons is the time that we have on this planet is for all people, for all of us, it's the most precious thing that we have, especially the quality of the time that we are in prison, of that we are alive when we are on this planet. And the basic question is, how important is the quality of life of somebody who committed a crime? How important do you think that is? And how important is it when this person is a stranger? And how important is it when it's your son or your brother or your father? How important then is the quality of time of this person? It's a very basic question, I think. And I posted questions hundreds of times in all kinds of places.
The problem is, Franz, I believe, is that there are too many who think that the quality of life to a person who has committed a crime is not, you know, not important.
I think so, too.
And you know, what's interesting is that, you know, we all have self-interest, and you would hope that the correction officers could be made to understand that by providing a safer environment, a kinder environment, a calmer environment, it's better for them as well, you know, rather than the bullying and the tough guy. And, you know, I love how you describe the way things are in the Netherlands, where the penitentiary workers don't wear uniforms, where they'll engage, you know, how did you sleep? Are you having a good day? You know, humanize it. And I would, you know, have you any data on how that has lessened violence in you know, any data proof of how it has, how much it has lessened the violence in the prisons?
Well, what I can say is that in general, the number of incidents was very low in the Netherlands, the violence in the prison. Actually, I'm proud of the fact that in my prisons the violence was very, very low, the lowest even in for many years in the country. I know that the violence is increasing again in the last few years in the prisons due to all kinds of repressive measures, which are also caused by the fact that in the Netherlands we are very, there's a fight going on against drugs criminality, a sort of war on drugs, which makes our prisons a lot more repressive. And amongst the people there is more, the people in the Netherlands are asking for higher and more repressive punishments in prisons right now. So, and what you immediately see is that the number of incidents increase incredibly. The suicides, the killings, immediately. And that's what's going on right now.
You know what I see happening? I see happening when companies are successful in what they do, and they're showing the United States ways to resolve these issues. The United States has always been so above all other countries. Not only do they suppress their own people in the United States, their own citizens, but they want the world to know that they're in control of everything, over them as well. So every time something positive is spoken of in such a loud way from other countries, just like in the United States, when things work, somehow all of a sudden, because everybody's talking about how these things are working, all of a sudden something happens. We have to look at who's behind a lot of these things that are occurring. And why is it happening after there's so much discussion about ways that the United States government can improve their system? I just find a lot of these things happening after the fact. And we need to look at it. We need to look at it. I feel countries could be working out their own problems when it comes to even what's happening right now with Ukraine and Russia. But it's not happening because I hate to say it, but this country's been interfering in so many ways that now it's almost like an adult that has been babied so much, that has had somebody taking care of them so much, that they depend on that person instead of depending on their own abilities. That's the way I look at it.
We need to
let those handle it. The United States is not the only country in NATO. So why is it that the United States is the only country that's involved in a dispute that could have probably been worked out and negotiated between two oppressive countries? We have problems in our own country that are not being addressed. One of them is mass incarceration. Another one is racism. You know, another one is crime on the rise.
Mm-hmm.
We need to focus on some of these issues or we're going to lose out completely. We're the only country now being looked at by other countries as the failure. Mass incarceration, high recidivism rate, suicide's gone crazy, especially in the prisons.
Poverty.
Poverty, yes, poverty.
Poverty and the daily show that we all follow of a criminal, your former president. Every day we see, this morning there was a message again that he was
indicted
again, and everybody thinks, well, every time he gets indicted, people, his votes raise, you know, he gets more support. That's a very sad situation, you know, when you're in prison, like the guy who was incarcerated for something he didn't do, you had in the show. When he sees what happens with Trump, what can he think about that, you know?
Exactly.
It's a very bad example.
If it was any other person, they would have been in prison years ago. But what's going to happen, even to this day, as you say, it's on the news 24/7 on CNN and on MSNBC and it's on 24/7 about Donald Trump. And he won't go to court, his lawyer will. This is dragging on where the money spent on trying to prosecute him or sentence him is spent, it could be spent on their own people in this country. Or the money sent to Ukraine, which is billions and billions of dollars, it could be spent on people in the streets, could be spent on reducing mass incarceration, could be spent on domestic violence situations, could be spent on runaways, could be spent on the abducted, could be spent on people in the streets. You know, it's just so much. I just get so upset when I hear about these things, and they don't make enough sense.
Yeah.
But this is why we have mental illnesses in the United States. We have an epidemic of mental illnesses and addictions. And as I say all the time, people that are addicted are not always addicted because they enjoy doing it. It's because they're trying to cover up pain that they have gone through. Like Kelly lost his mother's house, He lost his fiance. He lost his brother and his father to suicide, his mother to cancer. And here he is in prison alone. When he comes out, which he's supposed to be coming out in another year or two, we'll have nobody. And that must be weighing on the mind as well.
Yes, very much, very much. I personally think that he doesn't have a fair chance, you know? Nobody gives him a fair chance.
No.
And nobody gave him a fair chance from a very young age when he was still a child.
No.
And without chances, you know, it's not possible. We all need other people. Nobody can do it alone. Nobody. Mm-hmm. You know, when you see how the people are successful, you have to admit that it's because a lot of other people who supported them and gave them the chance to do it. You know, nobody can do it alone.
No. But if it was successful in your country, the recidivism rate, the sentencing guidelines, and I must say, Donna talked about it. She went to the testimonies at the State House, and she talked about the bills that are out there. And Donna, if you can talk a little bit about that again, I'd appreciate it, because that was very important to me.
It was amazing, and I would love to see this these testimonies. There's some material which I could see.
I will send, do you have the link, Leona? I can send the link to Fonz, and he can see the testimonies. You know, you can see, watch the testimonies of the inmates, which was just amazing. And I'm just grateful they're getting a voice. And I'm grateful for, you know, our editor, Afimi, that she edits the newsletter and the blog, and that she's helping give voice through this article that I just read on the air. I'm grateful that we have to communicate. We have to have transparency, because unchecked, it's a very frightening thing. And Franz, you said something that really struck me. You know, working with the families of loved ones who are basically incarcerated and mentally ill, you know, we just want to know that they're safe so we can sleep easy. And even you also mentioned poverty, and I, you know, the grocery store, I went shopping with my husband the other day. The prices have gone like 50% up, and I'm thinking, you know, how is it that people who are struggling, how are they making it? There's just so many problems. And also the other thing with the groceries, you know, feeling very blessed that we can buy some organic products and, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and a few treats, and knowing the slop that they get fed through the prison system, it's just, you know, we agonize over the poor quality of food at Bridgewater State Hospital, and we just have no peace of mind many days.
We just want our loved ones
to have that quality of life, a basic quality of life, and we don't feel, we share stories. We know a lot about lapsed medical care and neglect, and the new disability law report from the Disability Law Center, the report on Bridgewater State Hospital came out, and I just got the email. I know they're still recommending that Bridgewater State Hospital goes to the Department of Mental Health. I have not been able to read that report yet, but at least there is some oversight. But in spite of the oversight and pointing out the issues, report after report, change is slow to come. So we fight on, we don't give up, and we're going to demand the changes that are necessary to sustain human beings with a decent quality of life, including nutritious food. And I do think, I have to say, the hospital is trying. They tell us that they have a new nutritionist and are going to revise some of the food. So we'll wait and see and hope that is the case.
I wanted to ask, Bronz, too, when you were talking about the incarcerated that your prison had, they were doing the farming. They were growing
mm-hmm.
in. Now, were they allowed to eat the same foods that they were growing in the fields?
Well, what actually happened was that in my prison was the only prison in the Netherlands where incarcerated people all could cook themselves.
They could order
stuff from an outside shop. And what I did was I said to the caterer who had this black plastic plates with prison food, which is not healthy at all, you know, it's not good at all. I said to him, well, I don't need your stuff anymore. And the money that I spent on the caterer, I gave that to the prisoners. So every prisoner got the budget that I had to spend every year for the caterer. And they could do shopping with that. And what happened was, I was known as the guy who, the warden, who wanted to support autonomy amongst prisoners. So you're the warden, they said, who wants us to cook and to grow food and to cook their own grown food. And they, the prisoners asked me to for a meeting, and they said to me, well, we really like the idea of cooking, and we also like the idea of cooking our own stuff from the garden, but we suggest that we give those our products for free for poor children in the community. So what actually happens is, and it still happens until today, is that all those projects, of most of those projects, are given to poor people in society, because the incarcerated people said, we had a poor upbringing with fast food and poverty, etc., etc., and we grow real healthy biological vegetables, and we want those poor children to eat that. So, and it was also something to do something back to society, you know, and I agreed with them. So I gave permission to give it to the poor children in the community. It was the idea of the guys themselves, and well, they had money from the enough money to cook food, and they could cook. They are very creative in cooking food together. You know, you can imagine that when you you go to a shop to do your groceries for one or two people, it's pretty expensive. But when you, with a group of, for example, a cooking group of seven or eight incarcerated people, you use the money of the institutions to do your shopping list and get your groceries. And you also add something. Everybody, for example, adds a dollar, you know, to make your budget a little bit bigger. Yeah, you can cook fantastic meals, you know. And that's what happens all the time.
I think that's awesome.
And
I think by giving those inmates some agency, some autonomy, you know, that is a way to make them more human and to and to give them respect and dignity. And I can imagine they were creative with the budgets. Just a little curiosity, you know, you have people from different cultures. How do they figure out making meals that everybody would like? I know one of the patients at Bridgewater, you know, who was Haitian, really missed his Haitian rice and beans, and available.
We had we learned a few very interesting things. One of the things that we learned, because the cooking facilities weren't great, you know, you had departments of sometimes 40 or 50 incarcerated people, and you only had one kitchen, you know? So I said to the representatives of the incarcerated people, well, we can't arrange, organize for you who has to cook when, you know, and who you want to cook with, because people from different cultures eat different food.
Yeah? Correct.
They cook in a different way. So you really have to organize it yourself. And I don't want any trouble and any quarrel between you and fights and stuff like that. Because when you start doing that, I can't allow you to cook anymore. So what happened was that they automatically made groups with friends who, you know, were good with each other. And we never had, for years, we didn't have any problem in the kitchen. They just did it, you know. Everybody could cook. Everybody could eat. Even the psychiatric department. I had a psychiatric department in the prison, and those were really, really disturbed people who couldn't function in the general community. Sometimes psychotic or with all kinds of other mental problems, depressive, suicidal, etc., etc. And first, we thought, they can't cook themselves. Everybody can cook, but they need to eat the food, because they can't. They're so individualistic. We can't work together, etc., etc. So then a guard from that department, he came to my office and he said, Frans, you really need to come to the psychiatric ward, because the guys want to talk to you. So I went there and they said, well, we also want to cook. You know, we can do it, and we can do it together. So, well, let's give it a try. Let's give it a try. And they started cooking as well. And that was about 10 years ago. And they still do it today. And there never was a problem. So people who are seen as troublemakers, because the people... you still listen? People from the psychiatric ward are seen as troublemakers. They have a lot of trouble in all kinds of prisons. But when they got this responsibility and this autonomy, they managed to do this. And it was like a little bit like a miracle, because nobody expected that.
That's phenomenal. I am collecting and organizing ideas on pilot programs for the inmates. And one of the things that, similar to what you did, is that this is agroponics, so I guess it's growing in, you know, produce and water, but the Springfield, Massachusetts jail is doing that, and they divide. They do some of the produce for the inmates, and they also do some of the produce for the community to help people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's one idea, but I love this cooking idea. This is going on my list. Thank you, Franz.
And a very important thing about all those things, about autonomy, is that it's not a project of the prison. It's not a project of the staff. The owners of this project, of this cooking project, are the incarcerated people themselves. The institutions...
In order for it to succeed, though, the institution has to be willing to, you know, let go of some of the tight control. They like to control everything. So getting them to do that, you know, we need a lot more people like Franz Dell, you know, to get to do that. But I can pose that, you know, when I'm get the opportunity through the Family Advisory Council someday, hopefully, and to present some of these ideas for pilot programs, you know, I would like to propose this idea and hope that somebody, one of the sheriffs or superintendents will grab onto it. And I just read that recently Barnstable County Jail has decided to hire its own private health care, just like Superintendent David Tuttle of Worcester County Jail did. So rather than depend on, you know, the DOC providing the health care, he gets more. The sheriff at Barnstable County Jail will have more say-so and more immediate action by hiring his own medical staff. He doesn't have to go through the hoops of, you know, DOC policies.
One of the most important things is also do your projects small scaled, so close to the institution. No big systems. You can do that with healthcare, of course, but you can also do it with the prison job. Usually in the Netherlands, and it's probably the same in the United States, big companies, they provide the prison with articles for the prison shop, where the prisoners or the visitors can get some stuff to eat and etc. Well, I'm a real promoter of a shop run in the prison, run by the inmates themselves, you know? It creates jobs, it creates value, it creates quality. So everything which is as small scaled as possible can be organized in a human measure, you know? So I think that's a very...
I appreciate that advice because, you know, I always felt like they only a small percentage of the jail or prison population gets to have the benefit of these programs like the garden program food program. But, you know, you're saying that it makes sense to have the small scale. Could you expound on that, Franz?
Yeah. Small scale, so that you can give the prisoners autonomy in it, give them ownership about their own living environment, and let them create a safe environment. And when they can be in a safe environment, you will see that the violence will get a lot less. And it's also they have something to lose, you know. When you have the a community in which you don't have to be scared, you can move through the whole building. You have meaningful activities, etc., etc. You can have good contact with your family. There are facilities to have good contact with your family. Then you don't need to, you don't want to lose that. So you do everything to keep that. And, especially in the prison where I had this garden project and the dogs projects and all those were long-term sentence prisoners, they had their own system of keeping the drugs out of the prison because they didn't want to spoil what they had.
Well, what happens when that brings in the drugs?
Sorry,
what happens when it's the staff that brings in the... There was a recent report, the Falcon report, and it talks about, you know, some of the staff actually being on video doing, you know, the COs doing lines of drugs. And I actually... You know, I actually had the same compassion for their plight, you know, that they're in this terrible situation as I would for the incarcerated. But what happens when they're the culprits bringing in the drugs?
Well,
how does that, you know, how do you avoid those kinds of things?
Well, you can't avoid it. You can't avoid it. You would lie to the people when you would say that you can get the prisons drug-free. It's just not possible. It's not possible in the United States. It's not possible in any country. drugs get in. The only thing you can do to really fight against drugs in a successful way is improving the quality of life inside. So that people are busy with different things and don't need those drugs to get through the day, you know?
I wanted to.
That makes sense.
I wanted to thank you both, and I know I don't want to keep you on any longer, Franz. Your wife has been very patient with us, and I don't want to overdo it.
Okay.
Right.
Well, thank you very much. I will see you the 16th, I think.
I wanted to let I wanted to let the audience know next Wednesday, Donna Wynette, family, friends, and individuals for the mentally ill will be on next Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and Franz Dow from the Netherlands will be back on with us the following Wednesday. Franz, I am so thankful that you come on, and Donna, once again, I want to thank you both. You've been very insightful, and also, Franz, I think you're talking with Donna as well, because Donna has been doing a lot, and she's taken your advice, she's taken your suggestions, and I know Donna's going to end up getting these things out there to the proper people. Donna, thank you so much as well. So
thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank
you.
Thank both of you very much.
And Donna, you tell your husband I thank him as well. He's been pretty patient with us too. So audience, we're going to end this episode now. Again, Donna Wynette next Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, and Franz Dow the following week at 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. I thank you both.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.